Studio D Chevalier in Colorado Springs, Colorado. I'm Derek Knight from SonOfCheese.com. You're listening to the Son of Cheese Half Hour Power Hour. With us, as always, Colin Burton from FizzleAndPop.com.
Hello, everyone.
My sister Heather is in the room from Matt and Spam.
Hello.
And you know him, you love him from the two shows we did about radio earlier from broadcast fame Johnny Houston.
Yeah, I'm here.
And we have a special guest on the telephone, an actual celebrity, at least in the Bay Area, Mike Slavko, a.k.a. M. Dung.
Hello, I.
Hey. You know, it's no secret that radio has changed drastically in the past 10 years or so, but there was a point when you were a huge star in a major market. What was that like?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. I mean, I was a kid in San Francisco. It was really wild. Probably the best job anyone in, you know, starting out in the business, well, not starting out, but anyone in the radio business could ask for, you know?
Yeah.
The most high-profile slot on any radio station.
Before we get farther into that, what sort of influences did you have when you were growing up that might have steered you toward broadcasting as a career?
Well, I grew up in Detroit, and I grew up in the 60s. I was a kid in the early 60s, you know, like a little kid, 6'5", 6'6", stuff like that. My father was a ham operator. He used to do ham radio in the 40s. So up in our attic was his transmitter and all this old radio equipment. And I was fascinated by that, all that stuff when I was a kid. And one day my dad built a radio for me and gave it to me. And I'd sit there and tune in all these radio stations at night, because in the Midwest, especially in the winter, you could pull in stations from all over the country. And then the transistor radio was just coming out. And I think for some occasion I got one. And I'd listen to the radio at night in bed around 63, 64, especially after the Beatles arrived. But then Boss Radio and the real Top 40 radio started coming out on the AM. And, of course, Detroit had some real powerhouse stations, CKLW, others from around the country in Chicago, New York. I could pull them all in. So I was influenced, I would say, by those early Boss jocks and my love for rock and roll.
And did they specifically influence your trademark on-air style?
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course it did, you know. But, I mean, I wasn't trying to mimic any one person per se, but it was just that whole attitude, the excitement, the urgency.
Sure.
You listen to some of those old Boss jocks, man. Those guys were pretty wild,
mm-hmm.
Especially Wolfman Jack. I was a little too young for Alan Freed, but, you know, when you're a kid, especially when I was a kid at that time, there was, like, my parents' music, which was beautiful music, Ray Conniff, you know, all that stuff, and then the rock and roll was just still in its infancy. It was, I understood immediately that there was my music and their music, and I certainly dug my music a lot better. Probably the biggest impression was the Beatles' appearance on Ed Sullivan. I remember watching that, and it was like from that moment on, I knew that something was going to happen to me, and that's what I wanted. You know, it was just, it changed my life. You know, so I really had a real love of music, and that coupled with the emerging radio thing. This is way before FM.
Yeah.
Rock and roll went over to that side, but, you know, it just kind of like all came together for me.
Yeah.
So where did you get your start? What was your big break?
I was going to college at Grand Valley State Colleges. I guess it's Grand Valley State today. But that's in Allendale, Michigan, which is about 15 miles west of Grand Rapids. It's literally in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by farms, cow fields. You know, I don't know what it's like today, but back then it was like that. And they had a little 10-watt FM station there, WSRX. But I really had no intention of going into radio. I mean, I loved music, you know, but my goal was to be an actor. I was heavily involved in the theater. And the first year you went to college, you had to live in the dorms. So on my floor, I got this guy, Lee Harris, who was trying to become a disc jockey and worked at WSRX. And I started hanging out with him, and I went down there. And it was, like, so much fun, you know. And that's how I got my start. I got a job there. But the Dung thing didn't happen until later. I was just regular old Mike Slavko for a while.
Yeah, and that's probably a question that you've had to answer several times in your life, but never on this program. Why did you choose the name M. Dung as your air name?
Well, this was back in 76, 77, and punk was just coming out. And everybody was a punk, right? And this whole attitude, the punk attitude was pure rock and roll, you know. It was like total irreverence for anything, any established normal, you know, guidelines for being behavior. So I wanted to come up with a name that would be, well, actually, now that I think about it, there was a specific reason I came up with that name. I didn't get along with the GM at the student radio station, and the guy tried to fire me several times, but because I was a student who paid tuition, so they couldn't fire you. But he made my life really difficult. But as it turned out, he couldn't make me go away, so I decided to, like, torture the dude. I wanted to come up with a name that would be as offensive as possible, but yet you could say on the radio. So I called myself Shit, but I without saying it, right? it really bugged him. And so it had the desired effect, but
yeah.
It was a joke, right? I mean, it's like I said, well, I'm going to call myself Dung. It was just something to bug this dude. And it stuck. It's like all the kids started calling me Dung, and then I couldn't escape it. So
Dung Ghost Dick.
You know, but the Idiot Show, that was even before I started doing what I did on the radio. So the name came first, definitely.
And, you know, if you do a Google search on M. Dung, you get a ton of Vietnamese web pages, for one thing.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
They're very fine dog recipes.
Well, it can be. It depends on what you're searching for, but that's usually what comes up first. I had read something that you had for a while. You had your resume up on your website. I read somewhere that you wrote where you are, and I'm not going to get the exact quote quite right, but you said that you were tired of identifying yourself by which stations you worked at. But what stations have you worked at?
Well, I've worked professionally at WLAV in Grand Rapids, and there was a two station company. The AM was WLAV, the FM was LAV-FM, which was a 50,000-watt FM rock station in western Michigan. It covered literally half the state down into Indiana and on a good night into Illinois. That was my first big job, and from there I went right to San Francisco. So there was a huge culture shock on my part coming from the Midwest in Grand Rapids, which was a little tiny city compared to San Francisco. Out here to California, which was like completely different.
Yeah.
So from Grand Rapids I went right to San Francisco. Once I left the Bay Area the first time, I went back home and I got a job in Detroit at WLLZ, which was at the time a big rock station. It was one of the rock stations I grew up listening to in high school. And being able to be on the air doing rock and roll in my hometown was a big thrill. From San Francisco, from Detroit, I went to Phoenix, Arizona. I worked at KZON. What else? Okay, and then I came back to the Bay Area and worked at KFOX in San Jose. And that was the last station I worked for.
Yeah, I used to actually try to get off early. I was working nights at that time, but I tried to get off early to come home to try and stream your show just to see what you were doing.
Hmm.
The reason that I know who you were was because I had picked up a CD of M. Dung's Idiot Show Classics out of the bargain bin. And when I heard the bits of on air that was on that CD, just the Hello I and the crazy stuff, I was just fascinated. It was after, I think I'd picked that up sometime like around 96. By that time, you know, everything, not everything was the same, but it was just amazing to me to hear somebody like that, and I was thinking, wow, I need to have that much, because at the time I was working at an oldies radio station and then also doing an oldies show on an AM station on Sunday mornings, and I was pretty much given free rein on that oldies show, and I was thinking, I need to have as much fun on the air as this guy sounds like he's having.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, you were an influence to me in a real remote way. But what of all those places that you worked at, what was your favorite place to work at?
Well, probably my first job at LAV-FM was the most exciting for me, because I never expected anybody to hire me to do what I was doing. I mean, when I started doing my show in college, it was basically because I was the program director of the station. And I really wanted the station to be on 24 hours.
Yeah.
But the guy who was doing overnights stopped showing up. So I ended up doing it. And after about a week of that, I got so sick of being there all by myself with, you know, trying to stay awake, that I just decided to amuse myself, basically, and just did this insane show. And actually, I started getting a following. And that was the first time I realized that I was doing something that people actually responded to, you know. Because it was like in the middle of the night in Allendale, Michigan. I'd get calls from farmers milking their cows wanting to hear songs. And it just kind of took off from there. But the thing is, it was just there, you know. It was like, I'm going to take my show on the road. I mean, the way radio was at the time, it was all the mellow FM DJs, you know. And
yeah.
Dung was just so far away from that. But by chance and luck, I was hired by this guy who used to listen to me. He was the program director of LAVFM.
Yeah.
And he stuck me on. My first big break was the Sunday Night Idiot Show, which was basically I was on Sunday from midnight till 6 a.m. and given 6 hours to just go completely insane on a 50,000-watt FM station.
And that was going to be our next question.
Yeah, actually, was to ask you about the Sunday Night Idiot Show, how it got started, and what you did on that show.
Well, that's pretty much how it got started, you know.
I started
doing it in college to relieve boredom.
Yeah.
And then when it went on the LAVFM, it took a while. I mean, I used to get death threats. it was a big deal. The way they introduced me to the radio listeners was I took over the station.
Oh, okay.
So the program director's doing his show, and during his last break, I burst into the studio, drag him out of the chair, and I tell everyone I've taken over the station.
That's awesome.
Start playing Gene Vincent, Buddy Holly, you know, Little Richard.
Perfect.
Listeners had called the police. And there was a bunch of people outside the radio station on the street yelling for them to arrest me. I mean, it was a big deal. So
I'd call that a success.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, man.
Now, when you were at KFOG, you had a theme song for the Idiot Show, or the Nomads, a band called the Nomads did your theme song. Could you tell us a little bit about them and how you got around to having them do your theme song?
Oh, the Nomads. Yeah, they from Berkeley. They're the guys in the Rubinews. And they were Idiot Show fans, and you know, I think they sent me the tape. They had recorded, just because they were fans of my show, they recorded this song, and it blew me away. It was so cool, and I lost all that stuff, but they sent me the tape with the song without the little bits of me saying stuff in between.
Yeah.
And then just a musical break, so I could talk over it
mm-hmm.
live on the air, which is what I did. That was one of the themes I used. There were several others I did for the Idiot Show. But the Nomads were former members of a Berkeley rock band called the Rubinos.
Okay.
And actually, we appeared live and performed together that song at one of my live Idiot Shows in San Francisco, and I was dressed up as Elvis. It was pretty wild. That night was pretty crazy.
How many live Idiot Shows did you do in San Francisco?
Quite a few. Well, I guess a few. It didn't last long for whatever reason. It wasn't because they were popular, you know. I don't really remember why they stopped happening, but it started at the Stone in San Francisco, which was the Keystone down the peninsula in the Bay Area. I think they owned a club in either Palo Alto or San Jose. It was Palo Alto. They had one club in San Francisco and the Keystone up in Oakland or somewhere around there. The Keystone Berkeley. It was in Berkeley.
Okay.
Anyway, from there I went to Wolfgang's, which was a club owned by Bill Graham, and we were pretty tight with the Bill Graham folks, so I did a lot of stuff for them. Also, then it became like a thing where I was more or less a promotional, too. You know, buy some time on the station, and Dung will come out and do a show from your place. And from then, it just kind of like went away. But it lasted a couple of years, I guess.
Sounds like.
You know, there was a lot of that stuff, man. I made a lot of appearances.
Yeah.
During that time, so I can't remember all of them.
Plus, it was San Francisco, and you were having just probably the time.
No, I had lots of New Year's parties, that kind of stuff. Just insane stuff. And I, a couple of clubs that I hung out at where I knew the owners really well, so I'd get up on stage and introduce bands and stuff. But officially, the Live Idiot Show thing lasted, I don't know, a couple of years, like I said, and then it kind of just went away.
Yeah. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the Rhino CD, the Idiot Show Classics, how did that come about? Did Rhino approach you about producing the CD?
No. There was a band called the Dynatones in San Francisco that I was friends with and promoted locally. Their manager, his name was Rick O.T., was also he was involved with Rhino in some way. He was really good friends with the guy who started the company. He was either part owner or an investor or something. He was affiliated with them in some way.
Okay.
And they approached, I believe our promotions person at the station approached Rico with this idea. That got the ball rolling. I guess the project was approved, and then I was told to come up with a list of songs that I wanted to include on the CD. And then once that was approved, I had to cut the tracks for the CD in the studio here, and then that's really all I did. I just gave them a list of songs I wanted on it, cut my breaks, and they did the rest. And I thought, bingo, I've got a record out.
Well,
pretty wild.
Well, your song selection saved my ass more than once doing live shows, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I wish I put a little bit more time into thinking about what I wanted on it, you know, but I just sat down and thought, well, you know, I'll just come up with a bunch of stuff I'd like to listen to and knock it out in, you know, a few minutes.
Yeah, well, it's the selection on the CD is really good, including the specific Shake Your Tail Feather, the version that's on that.
Five Deutones.
The Five Deutones, which apparently was huge in St. Louis because I did an oldies show for a group of guys that had graduated high school in the same high school in St. Louis, and they were coming back for a reunion, and they kept asking me, I need to hear the Five Deutones. I need to hear the Five Deutones. And I'm thinking, I know I have that. So thank you for the song selection, because in some strange way, that saved my ass.
Cool.
But with the rise in podcasting and the ease and popularity in which things like this stuff that we're doing right now happens, do you ever think that you'll have a chance to resurrect the Sunday Night Idiot Show, or is that just too much work for you now?
Not on commercial radio, no way.
Yeah, but I mean, as a podcast that you could produce and then put it up on the web for people to download.
Well, you know, it's something I used to do it actually before there were iPods.
Right.
I streamed my show from my website. I produced a little half-hour idiot show just for fun.
Yeah.
Tired of doing that. You know, the thing is, I've done it. I've done everything I set out to do.
Yeah.
I did a lot more than I ever thought I could do. I lived that life for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I really don't have anything left to say. So, no, I really don't anticipate, going back to it.
Yeah. And
if I did, it would be because it's something that I wanted to do.
Sure.
But I really don't feel the need to do it, so who knows? You know, I won't say no,
yeah.
But I just say, I guess I should say, I don't know.
So you're really just not driven.
Possible, I guess, but...
Yeah. Well, and our friend Johnny, he has a theory about once you've worked in radio, it's like a monkey. What was your theory again there, Johnny?
Well, this isn't a theory. What it is I found in a radio station control room many, many, many years ago, it was just a quote out of a book. I have no idea where it came from. I don't know anything about it. I don't have it in front of me here, so I'm going to have to paraphrase it. But it basically said that once you have ever worked in the business, that you never find anything quite as thrilling again. So it's kind of like a monkey on your back. You never really shake it. You keep coming back to it, even though the pay's lousy. And as we all know, the environment sometimes can be pretty horrible as well. But it's just kind of a thing that you never can quite shake. And I don't know if I totally agree with that, but I think there is some truth in it.
Well, I do agree with that. I mean, it's hard to find a job as dynamic and exciting as being a disc jockey, but there is life after radio. I can attest to that. But it was a real challenge for me because literally that's all I ever did since I got out of college. I was a disc jockey for, you know, from 1980 till 1997. I mean, that's almost 20 years. That's all I did.
Yeah.
So when I decided that I no longer wanted to put up with the BS associated with radio and I was still young enough to change my life around and go for a new career, I was saying, okay, well, what exactly is that career going to be? You don't know how to do anything else. So because of my radio experience, I found out I was a natural salesman. I was used to being in front of public. I had good speaking skills. I'd been in every public kind of scenario you can imagine. So I was good with dealing with people. I could think on my feet, and it really helped me. After leaving the radio station in San Jose, I was looking around for something to do, and finally I walked into this Mac shop, Computerware, which is no longer in existence, and applied, and they hired me. And I was a salesman, and I was pretty good at it. And luckily for me, while I was a disc jockey, when I was in Detroit, one of my coworkers had this little Apple PowerBook. I thought it was the coolest fucking thing I'd ever seen in my life. I'd come into work just to play around on his computer before my shift, you know. And finally, I borrowed the money from my mom and my aunt and bought my own computer. So this was kind of like a parallel thing I was into while I was a disc jockey. And I developed a real love for computers and found out that I had some aptitude in it, so I was pretty good at it. So hence, that's why I applied at the Mac store, because I knew the computers.
Right.
And while working there, one of the weekend guys was an engineer at Apple who liked to moonlight as a sales guy just to see how the public, what they were interested in and stuff. It kind of helped him do his job.
Hmm.
He got me in. I worked at Apple for 2 years as a software tester, and that was an incredible experience. And from there, it led to what I currently do, which is like system administration for educational institutions. So I'm employed by a school, and I set up all the computer stuff and maintain it and do, you know, troubleshooting, that kind of crap. It's not quite as glamorous or high profile as being a morning guy in a major market.
And you probably make more money, too.
Yeah.
Well, no, not really. I don't know what disc jockeys make today, but I was pulling in some pretty good dough when I was working in San Francisco. I make enough money to get by.
Yeah.
I really don't have a big, lavish lifestyle or anything like that, but I'm certainly able to, you know, make a living for myself. And that's really, you know, that's what it's all comes down to.
Which is always good.
All, you know, that's all that matters.
Yeah. Are you still brand loyal to Apple?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, sure. But, you know, because of my job, I've come to get acquainted with all sorts of different types of computers and operating systems and, you know, software.
Well, we're currently recording this show into a dual-core MacBook Pro.
Oh, good. Good for you. Well, I own a ton of computers. My ex-wife thinks I'm insane. I own at least 30 computers.
Wow.
I don't use them all. So a lot of my older ones are in storage. Kind of one of my hobbies is restoring old computers.
Oh, okay.
So I'll get some kind of piece of crap and, you know, build it up so it works again. And I worked briefly at a place that did it professionally where I would refurbish hardware. So I'm kind of good with that. But, yeah, I'm totally into computers now. That's pretty much what I do.
Yeah.
I pay a little attention to radio or disc jockeys or any of that crap, unless I know them. There's a few still working in the business that I know, but most of the people I've known have either moved away or moved on or whatever, but are no longer in the business.
Yeah, so is it safe to say that you've been pretty much sufficiently burned and there's no prospects of you going back to a radio station at this point?
Why?
Well, no,
so I can be abused by these people again? No, thank you.
Yeah, well,
the thing is, the problem is today is that radio is basically run by business guys.
Yeah, well, and that's exactly, you know, right. And
radio used to be there used to be a certain dynamic within a radio station. This is before consolidation and all this crap.
Right.
You'd have the sales department, you'd have the general manager, and you have programming. And the PD, you know, could override any of these guys. I mean, he had a lot of power back then. And the general manager's job basically was to keep everyone from killing themselves and to motivate the sales department to make the company some money. Well, it's not that way anymore. The business guys have taken over all aspects of it. The problem is that the business guys do not understand radio.
Yeah.
And that's why it's shit today, because there's nothing compelling to listen to on radio.
You're absolutely right. I mean, that's the problem with corporate ownership is now if you listen to a classic rock station in San Antonio, classic rock station in Colorado Springs, Colorado, is classic rock station in San Jose, they're going to be playing the exact same format. And if you
that's probably because those stations are owned by the same company.
Exactly.
And quite often there's one person cutting tracks for a show that's used in several different markets.
Right. And they feel that if you stray from the music, everybody will suddenly turn off the radio, and that affects the bottom line, and all they care about is that bottom line, as opposed to doing anything new, fun, or different. And my sister actually started working in radio, got burnt. Well, why don't you tell briefly your story of how you got quickly burned out?
Well, I was only there for a couple of years, and it was just playing the same songs over and over. You cannot take requests. Do not listen to the public. Do what the, what are they called? The people, consultants tell you to do. And being a woman, the guy that was in charge of everything said, there is no future for you in radio because you are a woman. There is no place for women in broadcasting. Bye-bye. So that was, you know, that was my radio career.
Yeah. Sounds pretty much what the deal is. You know, I'll tell you something. You want to know what the essence of radio is and have a good understanding about what makes it so special. The movie American Graffiti,
yeah.
The scene where Richard Dreyfuss goes to meet Wolfman Jack.
Mm-hmm.
Rewatch that and watch that scene. That's exactly what radio is all about. And the thing is, you got to think to yourself, what is radio? Why was this medium invented? Well, the basic purpose of radio is to communicate.
Yeah.
Communicate new ideas and thoughts and establish a dialogue. It was a dialogue between the listener and then the guy doing the show. And that's what made it a compelling thing to listen to, because you never knew what you were going to happen. And it was always a possibility. And it was such it was theater of the mind, you know. I mean, when you're sitting there listening to the radio, you make these mental pictures of the disc jockey, or not so much today, but back then, you created this suspension of belief, you know. It was like theater.
Sure.
Today, that whole element has disappeared. I mean, when I was a kid listening to the radio, I could tell what station I was listening to by the disc jockey was on the air.
Yeah.
Not because he was saying the call letters every 10 seconds. He didn't even have to do that, because the personality was so big.
Yeah.
You just knew who you were listening to. And today, they'll figure out, believe me, they'll figure out a way to eliminate people completely.
Oh, yeah, I think Clear Channel is working on that.
They're
right
almost
now.
There.
Yeah,
they're almost there. Yeah, and when they can figure out how to do it, they will, and that'll be the end of it.
Yeah. Well, there's a station conglomerate here in town that's owned by Clear Channel that operates with, I think, two live bodies. And the rest of it is, four stations, I believe, and two live bodies. It's all voice-tracked with the exception of one or two live shows. And
yeah, my last station was KFOX. And when I was there for almost 3 years. In that three-year period, the station had changed owners three times.
Wow.
They had changed their call letters twice and changed their position on the dial twice.
Wow.
It was insane. But the last owner was Clear Channel. And they set in their hatchet man in there, and they completely dismantled both of those stations.
Yeah.
They fired most of everybody, and they were replaced by the tracks, you know, the people who didn't exist that came out.
You don't know what that's like at all, do you, Johnny?
I was one of those people.
I've worked with Johnny at a couple of stations, and he seems to – how many times have you been fired in this market?
No, I don't know, half a dozen or so.
Yeah, I used to say I've got tired of being fired for a living.
Yeah. That's
pretty much what it came down to.
Yeah.
I couldn't live like that anymore, man.
Yeah.
You know, it was like when you're a kid in your 20s, you know, you can just bounce back, no problem. But at that time in my life, I had a kid, and I got tired of starting over all the time.
Sure.
And I just said, well, that's it. You know, I mean, I'm just going to do something else.
Yeah.
For my own sanity and for the benefit of my kid, you know, I've just got to establish some kind of, like, career here that makes sense.
Certainly.
So, I don't know. You know, that's what did it for me, dealing with that mentality that Clear Channel has almost invented. You know, believe me, they've already destroyed radio. Not them, but just the way the business is today. It's
right.
Totally different than it was when I started.
Yeah. Corporate ownership doesn't – there's no room in corporate ownership for creativity or anything spectacular.
Well,
it's keep the music moving.
The program directors are puppets, you know. They do what they're told.
Exactly.
They rely on these focus groups to dictate their programming, which is probably the worst move in the world. And then they have these consultant guys trying to tell a station in San Francisco, and this is a guy who lives in fucking, you know, New York or somewhere else, you know, how does he know what the people in this community want to listen to? You know, it's just everything's screwy, and I just decided it was a good time to get out.
Yeah, as everybody except Colin in this room has decided at one point in their life. Luckily, Colin never actually worked in radio, so he's the only one that's been spared the pain. But
I miss it sometimes, you know, and sometimes I get that. I still get the itch sometimes to do it, you know, but then
the
I realize.
The monkey.
Yeah, well, you know, sure, I did it for a long time. And
sure, yeah.
I still, for a long time, I couldn't even listen to music, you know. I just associated it with work. And a lot of negative shit. So I've just finally got back to a place where I can listen to music again and enjoy it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I've tossed the idea around. Maybe I still will do it. I'm not saying I won't, you know.
Right.
But it'll be because I want to do it. And that's
exactly.
I'm never going to work for the suits again. Never.
Yeah. On your terms or not at all.
That's kind of where podcasting comes in as a possible substitute because you control the whole
thing. Yeah, I know. But, you know, the thing is... Yeah, I haven't been motivated enough to do it.
Right.
But maybe I will.
Yeah.
You know, I finally got, one of the big things holding me back was the fact I didn't really own a decent microphone.
Mm-hmm.
I had this like plain talk microphone that Apple gives you, which sounds like you're basically talking through a tin can.
Yeah.
But I got a little mixer now. I got it hooked up to my G5 and I actually have a pretty decent microphone. So I have the equipment to do it now, and now that I have the equipment, I don't want to do it. So I don't know. I might do it, you know. I mean,
give it some
someday,
time.
But
yeah.
I don't know. I've been there. I've done that. I really don't see the need to do it anymore.
Well, at least the possibility is there that someday we might be able to download M. Dung being crazy, talking, you know, playing some great music, and just having fun.
But the thing is, here's the deal. It's like when I was Dung, when I did that, I was in my mid-20s.
Right. Yeah.
I'm almost 50 years old.
Yeah.
So is that
past? Are you no longer?
Well, yeah, kind of. Yeah. You know, it'd be like you trying to act like a high school student or something. That ain't gonna happen. Or whatever. I mean, you draw your own parallels.
That's
but
true.
The thing is, I'm not that person anymore.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, when I was young and everything, and rock and roll was still, well, not new, but that aspect of it, playing, you know, a real thrill for me was being able to play music that you never heard anywhere else on the radio.
Yeah.
Right. And people responded to that like you wouldn't believe.
Oh, yeah.
That's part of the reason my show was so popular, because I was playing stuff that people remember from a long time ago that just stopped being played.
Yeah.
But yet was still a hit, you know, because mm-hmm. there was a lot of stuff in the top 100 that, you know, no oldies station would even look at today.
But yeah.
However, was still technically a hit that I remember, and a lot of people probably still do too. And they got a chance to hear this stuff again on the radio, and, you know, it was a very exciting experience for them.
Johnny and I have actually both experienced that. I did an AM show, a show on an AM station where I had complete control. So on one side, I was working on the FM real tight playlist. It was an oldies station, and I say that doing little quote things in the air with my fingers. And then I was able to play whatever I wanted, and I was playing Otis Redding and the Pine Toppers, and I was playing, you know, just really going deep, playing the Coasters, playing the Robins, playing some Fats Domino that people don't hear very often. And people would call up. Like you said, people respond to it. They'd call up. This guy started calling up every week, said, man, I haven't heard that Otis Redding in a long time. I used to have that record. Can you play that again for me? And it was gratifying because I knew I wasn't just crazy. People were actually enjoying it. And Johnny was given a show to do, kind of, called the Doo-Wop Cafe. And then it turned out that the program director started tightening. Isn't it? I mean, am I wrong, John?
No, you're right. The problem with it is that, you know, nobody wants to take a chance anymore. I think that's really the core of the issue if you want to get past all this other stuff. I mean, you can talk the corporate thing. Yeah, they want to make money, but let's not necessarily land right on them. Any corporation wants to make money. I mean,
right.
That's their mission in life. And if you think that if they aren't, then you're really naive or stupid, because
yeah.
that's what they want. And Clear Channel, the rest of them, are no different. They want to make money, okay?
Right.
I don't hold that against them. The problem is nobody wants to take a chance.
Yeah.
Yeah. All they want is a safe thing. We want to auditorium test it. If it doesn't come back the way we want it, we're never going to play it. That's all there is to it.
Which, in my opinion, is just,
you know,
insane.
Well, I agree with you totally on that. But the bottom line of it is they don't want to take a chance. That's why they have the homogenized formats, all of this. Let's not take a chance. Let's not push the envelope. Let's not do
anything.
They
don't even know how to take a chance, man.
Yeah.
I mean, these are people who don't know much about radio or even why people would listen to the radio.
And they don't care. You know, all they want is to make money. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
It's paranoia and it's stupidity. You know, they don't know. They wouldn't even know how to do radio show to save their lives.
That's true.
Unless someone told them what to play.
And so
it's like today in radio, their playlists are pre-programmed out weeks in advance. Most of the shows today are pre-recorded. So the request line has no purpose, you know. It's just some kind of promotional gimmick, I guess. But it certainly doesn't get you your request played. Unless you want to hear one of the 20 songs they play in regular rotation.
Yeah, one of the songs that happens to be coming up.
Yeah.
But that is as good a place as any to leave it, because sadly we are out of time. I'm Derek Knight of SetOfCheese.com. You've been listening to the Set of Cheese Half Hour Power Hour. With us as always, Colin Burton from FizzleAndPop.com.
Goodbye, everybody.
My sister Heather joined us from Matted Spam.
Bye-bye.
And Johnny Houston of Radio Fame.
Hey, thank you for having me again, Derek.
And a very special guest, really appreciate his time via the telephones all the way from sunny California. It's M. Dunn.
Well, it's nice meeting you all. Thanks a lot. I had fun.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll see you all again next Wednesday. We'll be right back.